Hey, this is your girl, Carla Renata. Do you know what a hired gun is?
I do, and Ray Parker Jr. is going to tell you too right after this.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movies.
Hey, yes. Y'all recognize that groove, right? That's from Chaka Khan's You Got the Love. And guess who wrote that and came up with it? Our guest today, Ray Parker Jr. Yes. Hey. We having a jam session in the studio.
There you go. I remember this like it was yesterday.
You give me the strength. Mm-hmm. You keep on living. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whatever it is, I can't do without. Is what you're giving. Yes, Ray Parker Jr. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes. We have Ray Parker Jr. here at Popcorn Talk. I talk movies or, you know,
I
talk whatever.
And I ate my popcorn already, so I'm just cleaning out
yeah,
my teeth.
Yeah, he done dogged out the popcorn already.
I'm for the second box now.
It's all good. Well, welcome. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to pop over here and talk to us about Hired Guns.
Yeah.
So Hired Gun is a documentary that I like to liken to, it's almost like a musician version of 20 Feet from Stardom.
It's very similar.
Yeah. So for those that don't know what a hired gun is, can you explain to our listeners and viewers
what that is?
A hired
gun is someone who sits at home, waits on a phone call, and he's obviously proficient at what he does, otherwise mm-hmm. the phone ain't going to ring at all.
Right.
And they call him up, and you go down to the studio. You either read the music or you learn it really fast, or you go on tour or something like that for a couple of dates, and you get paid to do your service. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the people treat you right, but there's been some misuse in the world, like not getting your credit or not getting your name on it, which I think that everybody puts your name on it now, I hope. Or like it is in the movie, some things I never even seen before, people getting fired a month ago, and then nobody didn't even get the phone call.
I know, like
that one part. Already fired.
Like that part. You know, that was crazy. How there was that one musician that talked about. He's like, you're never really fired. They just don't ask you to come out on the road again.
They just don't call you no more. That's right. You just don't get the phone call. So you end up buying your new house, and you think everything's cool, and you're ready to make the first payment. Only no one's called you anymore. So that's just it.
Yeah, that's crazy. So let's just dial it back a little bit and talk about your career a little bit before we get even more into the movie, because we can talk about the movie all day long. So I love the fact that there was a clip I saw of you on Unsung, on BET's Unsung.
Oh, you saw that Unsung, yeah.
Yes, of course I did.
That's TV One's Unsung. You don't get
TV One. Oops, sorry. Ooh, TV
right.
One's Unsung.
Two different stations, yeah.
Right? Oops.
I'm a little mad at BET.
I confused the
you
black people.
I'm going to say this. I'm a little mad at BET.
Why are you mad at BET?
Because they did the New Edition thing. It was a wonderful show.
Yes.
And they played my song over and over and over again. But then the guy who was supposed to act me, you know, do me, he didn't get to say anything.
In the movie?
Yeah. And then Michael Bivins came over and said, hey, Ray, is that okay? And that's it. I didn't even get to Parker Jr.
Well, yo, don't be mad at BET. You need to take that up with Michael Bivins. You know they wrote it.
It wasn't his fault. It was the producers, the TV show's director, you know.
Okay.
But I'm mad at everybody who did it. Oh. But they said plenty of Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, which is my boys. You know, I like
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they had their name in there plenty of times, you know.
Well, you know, sometimes.
So the guy that was playing me, he wouldn't even know it was me because they just say, hey, Ray, is that okay?
I'm like, oh, they didn't hey, even say Ray Parker?
No, they didn't even say Ray Parker Jr.
Oh, that's kind of busted.
That's kind of wrong.
Yeah, that's kind of wrong. Okay. That's wrong with a big old R. I'd be mad at them too.
Exactly. But the song played in every episode, whether I was in it or not. I mean, they were playing the song.
You getting a residual, ain't you?
Oh, of course.
Okay, then there's that. Yeah. So let's talk about you. When I watched Unsung, you talked about going to the Stevie Wonder School of Music.
Yes.
So tell
Wonder me. University, I'm going to call it.
I was, Wonder University.
I'm from Detroit, and everything in Detroit is the big three automobiles at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In fact, had I gone that route, I'd probably be unemployed now because it didn't go so well. But my dad was a blue-collar worker. Blue-collar worker meaning you're in your boots and you're out in the cold and, you know, in the weather,
right,
in the elements, doing right. your job, working in the factory. And his dream for me was to have a white-collar job. It's where you sit in the office and draw pictures, and you draw the car, you know, outline of the car door, engine, or whatever, mm-hmm. and they manufacture it.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't my dream. and the room was half the size of this one, and you get a maybe get a window, but you sit in there for the next 55 years, and that's where you spend 8-9 hours a day.
And you just didn't see your life going
no,
that way.
I looked at my dad, I said, why don't you shoot me now and get
over
it?
Oh, no!
And to make matters worse, at 18 years old, I had already graduated school early, so I was in college at 18. And I was in college at 17, but I was just about to turn 18, mm-hmm. and Stevie Wonder called me. And he said, you know.
Okay, wait. Let's just stop right there. Yeah. What was that like when you got a phone call from Stevie Wonder at 18 saying what?
It was unbelievably wonderful.
No
first
pun intended.
Of all, I didn't really hear what he said because, Music From My Mind was one of my favorite albums of all time. Mm-hmm. You know, Mary Wants to Be a Superwoman. So I love that stuff.
Mary Wants to Be a Superwoman. Yes.
Yeah, I love that song. And so when he called, I actually hung up the telephone on him.
Two or three times.
You hung up? I clicked. Because I thought it was some of my friends fooling around.
Oh, no.
And they called back, click, you know. And about the third or fourth time he called, I added some four-letter, lead-ins. And then I still went click. You know?
Oh, no. You hung up on him and cussed him out.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
Well, not in that order. I cussed him out, then I hung up. You know? And he called back again. He says, we really getting this. He says, just hold on a second. I'm going to play you something. And he played me the rhythm track to Superstition. I'll never forget that. The drum started off, then the bass came in. As soon as I heard the Moog bass, I knew I've been hanging up the telephone on Stevie Wonder. This is crazy,
Oh, wow.
So it sounded like a dream come true, but the part is I had to go talk to my dad.
Ooh, and what did Papa say?
Well, Papa had already saved money for me to go to college like 3-4 years before I was born. Right. He didn't know.
Yeah, that's what people used to do back in the day.
Okay, he was saving his mm-hmm. savings bonds.
My parents did that too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so for me not to be the first one in the family to finish college, as he put it, he had high hopes for me.
Ooh, it just made you guilty.
Crushing. Oh my
Ooh.
God. It was we can talk about it now and laugh, but at the time it was the biggest thing in my life that I can remember was going home to tell my dad, it's your dream, it ain't my dream, I don't want to do it.
Oh no!
I want to go be a rock star.
So how did it end up happening?
Well, once I told him he may as well shoot me first, and he told me you won't make any money as a musician because those guys don't make money. They play in bars and they live out of suitcases, and that's it. They make $25 a night, and that's it. I just said, I want to play music. I want to go on this tour, and it was the Rolling Stones tour that Stevie Wonder was on at the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I left. He finally let me go against his better judgment.
Of course he let you go. It's the Rolling Stones and Stevie Wonder.
He didn't know nothing about neither one of them. He didn't know who neither one was. Or could care less. He's like, my boy need to go to college and finish what he's doing.
So how did he feel when, now, and correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. you contributed to the Talking Book album by Stevie Wonder, yes?
Yes, I'm playing on that album.
And mm-hmm. you're playing on which track?
Maybe Your Baby Done Made Some Other Plan.
Mm-mm. Oh, we could just sit here and sing and jam right. all day. That is hilarious. So after all of that happens, you go on tour with the Stones and Stevie, and then you have this aha moment from being a hired gun to, I'm going to start my own group.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I didn't want to get fired. I mean, nobody ever really fired me, but I didn't want to
like
wait around.
Like they said, you don't get fired, you wait for the
stay
next
around
tour.
Long enough. Yeah, I didn't want to stay around long enough to get fired. And I thought I had learned a lot in working with I worked with many people before Stevie Wonder. Marvin Gaye, I did all his records, and Dinah Ross. I was her guitar player for years.
Because you lived around the corner or down the street from Motown,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I lived close to Motown. Mm-hmm. I did all the Holland Dozier Holland records. And when I came to California, I did all the Barry White records and the, Tom Jones records and the Carpenters.
Now tell us a story about what happened with Barry White. You went to him with a song, and what happened when that happened?
Oh my gosh, Barry White. First of all, he's a really, really nice guy. He was very patient with mm-hmm. me. I wanted to get his attention when I first got here, and I wasn't really on the session, but I had a great idea for a guitar part. Mm-hmm. So he plays his music really, really loud. He's humping and doing his thing. So I went in, little kid from Detroit, and I pushed the stop button, cut all the music off.
Oh no!
Oh yeah!
Oh, you were feeling yourself.
And he was steaming. He was looking around like, "What happened?" Then he looked over there. Who knows? Yes, is that? And I said, "Excuse me, Mr. White, but you need this guitar part." And and he thought it was got really quiet for a minute. Everybody's like, "He's gonna sit on you." So it got quiet for a minute. And he said, get out there and play it. So I played it. He loved it. And then we became best of friends. And I did something similar to that for the first song. He said, no one gets a song on Barry White's album. You can write for all these other artists I got, but you don't get a song on a Barry White album. And I pushed him in my little Mercedes car and let him listen to this song. And then he said, okay, well, yeah, that's nice, but we're going home. So he went home. I said, you go home. I'm spending, get the guys in the band to stay here extra late. Mm-hmm. And they cut the song for me. He ended up putting it on the album.
Oh,
then I still wasn't happy.
Now, why weren't you happy? He put because the song on the album.
It was on his instrumental album with Love's Theme. I said, but I wanted it on him singing.
Oh.
So then the next time I did that, he came over. His manager lived in my building. And I drove. He parked illegally in the near too close to the fence. But that didn't matter to me. I just had to get my car around so I could play him the song. But when I pulled around, the gate opened, hit his car, lifted it off the ground. Then the gate came off the building and fell on top of his car and just wrecked the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
And he says, yeah, thanks, Ray. I needed it. But I didn't really care. I still was pushing my song. I said, well, you know what? Now that that's happened, you need to listen to this song. Cheer you up. You know. So he ended up writing the lyrics to that song. And we sold like 7 million records.
That's wonderful. Really
big hit. It's called You See the Trouble with Me.
Wow. Yeah, so. That's wonderful. Okay, so now.
So I was ambitious, to say the least.
You know. I'd say so. Yeah. So now you've gone to the Stevie Wonder music school. Yeah.
Wonderland.
Wonderland. You've gone through the ranks of Wonderland.
Yes.
You have pitched your song to a major R&B artist, Barry White, eventually got on his album. You had that aha moment of, I'm not trying to like get fired. Let me just go ahead and do my own thing.
Yeah.
And now you finally get with an artist where you write a song that's thebomb.com, and then you don't get credit for it. It ends up becoming a number one hit. It yeah. ends up winning a Grammy.
Yeah, how about that?
That song was what?
You Make Me Feel Like Dancing.
By Leo Sayer, yeah?
Yes, yes.
So tell us, what happened with that situation?
Well, the producer, his name was Richard Perry. He's a good friend of mine. I mean, I still think he's... I don't know why he did that, because I made a lot of money with Richard Perry. We had a great thing going. I did Barbara Streisand and just a whole bunch of records that he did I was playing on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when he came in and he wanted to use the song, I said, you know, that's my song. He says, don't worry about it. I'll take care of you. And I wanted to believe him because I've been working with him for a long time.
There was trust there.
There was trust built up, yeah. And I gave him Jack in Jail, too.
Mm.
So it was two songs here.
Mm.
And luckily for me, Clive Davis really liked Jack in Jail. And he said, well, don't record it for him. He didn't pay you for the first song, you know.
Right.
And, you know, at that time, there were witnesses there. Everybody in the band, I put the band together. So it was my group of guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I could have sued, but I never really sued anybody.
Why is that?
Well, you know.
Well, okay, let me back it up. So you didn't sue anybody. Did you not sue because of what the future repercussions behind that would bring? Or did you not sue because you figure, what's the point? The damage has already been done.
No. Sometimes I wish I'd sued, but I didn't really sue because... If you're going 800 miles an hour, it's hard to see what's behind you.
That's true.
Okay, so in that mode, I was just going fast. I mean, I was just going this way. So I took all the positive things in, and I embraced all the positive things and just kind of ignored
all
the negative
stuff. You know,
yeah.
That's a good way to look at it. Because
yeah.
Some
you know how long I'd be in court of fighting and then
oh,
there'd
be
negative.
Oh, you still be in court. You still be in court fighting over
and
that.
And how negative that is. And it makes you it's not write negative. The other songs that you might have written because you're still fighting over the other stuff. So...
There's a, to just flip back to the film for a second, there is a big chunk of Hired Gun, the documentary, where some members of Billy Joel's band...
Ouch.
...are spoken to and how they were treated and how, yeah. you know, there was a very similar situation to yours, not quite, but, yeah. but elements of it are similar. So, you know, when y'all go out and see the movie, which opens on June 29th, through Fathom Events, go to fathomevents.com. You'll see what I mean. I'm not going to, like, ruin it for
give
you.
Give away all of the punchlines.
I'm not going to give away everything. I'm just going to give away a few little nuggets.
That's right.
Just a few nuggets that you want to go and see it. But, yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah.
So it's good that you embrace the positive, because then the biggest thing that ever happened to you in life happened, and that was Ghostbusters.
Well, yeah. Yes. Some years later, I cut that. Who would have thought? I mean...
That is crazy.
You know, it's funny. At that point in my life, my parents had gotten sick. And I really thought I'd done all my best work. I said, okay, you got a great deal here. You got an awesome money. You got all these six, seven golden platinum albums in a row. And I thought everything was wonderful. And then a friend of mine called me from the Barry White days, by the mm-hmm. way. He had become the vice president of Columbia Pictures. And he says, you're the right guy to write the lyric and stuff to this song. Ghostbusters. He said, we tried everything. Nobody can come up with a song that the director likes.
Now, wasn't it true that they had shopped it around to several different people and they didn't like it. And then there were elements of the song that Huey Lewis thought it was his song or something like that. Okay.
They had hired
Clear it up for me.
Yeah, they had hired a whole bunch of songwriters to write the song. Mm-hmm. But nobody wrote anything that the director liked.
Mm-hmm.
And
the director was Ivan Reitman.
Yeah, director was Ivan Reitman. And Gary thought that I was the right guy with my sense of humor to write this song. And he was adamant about it. He was like 100% sure. In fact, he was so sure, he says, I'll give you $50,000 if you just stay here one more weekend and work on it. He says, if you can give me some money come Monday morning, whether I like it or not, you can keep the money. I was like, well, he's putting his money where his mouth is. He's serious about this thing, you know. And so I met with Ivan Reitman, and he told me what he wanted. And I figured, I can do it. I'm a musician. I've been doing this all my life. I can knock this out. Then they threw the curve at me. But I want the words Ghostbusters in the song. And it doesn't sing well, you know. It's not fair for you to hear it now because now you know
the trick. Well, now we know what it is.
You know the trick that I pulled off to it.
Right,
but I mean, picture me sitting at home. Oh, I'm going to Ghostbusters. I'm going to be the Ghostbusters. It just didn't sing well. It was corny. I mean, it just, you know, it was terrible.
Let's take a look at the video so that people can get a sense of what that feels like. Here it comes.
In a year and a half, calling everybody. We've hired everybody. We spent millions of dollars. But the director is insistent upon the word Ghostbusters must be in the song. Ghostbusters! And I told Gary, I said, well, that's nice, but I'm going back to Detroit. I'm not doing this. I'm like sort of, not retired, but sort of retired. You mean if you don't like it, I get to keep your fee? He says, yeah. If we hate it and you turn it to music, you get to keep the $50,000. Stayed up 2 or 3 days, wrote the song, gave it to him. And the director, Ivan Reitman, called me at 3:30 in the morning. He loved it. 2 weeks into this deal, Clive Davis said, we sold 4 million records overseas just on imports. And at the Needham Festival, they were already presenting me with a 10 million selling album.
Isn't that something? Whose phone is that? Is it mine?
That's yours. See, I
Ooh,
turned
no.
mine off.
See there? Isn't that terrible?
Tell them people not to call you here.
I know. Oh, sorry, y'all.
So the unique part of this song is if you look at the first movie, there's a part of the movie where the Ghostbusters had the phone number at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're all holding their backpacks, and it's four of them.
Mm-hmm.
To me, they look like the insect guys or the Roto Rooter guys, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I reflected back to
Orkin.
And I said, you know, the only way this song is going to work is if I don't say Ghostbusters. So I came up with the phrase, who you going to call? Then I let the crowd.
Ghostbusters!
Right. And I was dating this 17-year-old Valley girl at the time. That's a whole nother issue. Don't spend all my time talking about that on the show.
I'm not. You brought it up.
But she got her friends to come at like 7:30 in the morning before they went to school. It was their first time ever in the studio. And they just sounded so excited. You know, you get that excitement.
That energy.
And they were Valley people, so they had that California Valley sound. You know, just had that.
Ghostbusters.
That against my Detroit accent was just cool. It just worked. You know, it was like me in a different genre, and the whole thing just, you know, was just
How long did it take you to write that song?
Like 3 days.
That's it?
Yeah, I mean, recorded too, everything.
So you wrote it and recorded it in 3 days?
Yeah, 3 days.
Wow. And how much time passed between the time the song was recorded and the film came out?
Oh,
and
we knew it was... That was just a few weeks, a couple of weeks.
Billboard was up there with the circle.
No.
So they were already...
Before I wrote the song.
Right.
When Gary called me, I was sitting in Spago and I was looking out the window at the billboards. Like, what is this thing? He says, you seen this black billboard with the red circle? I said, yeah, I'm looking at it. He said, they look like getting ready to paint something else on there.
Right.
He says, that's it. That's the one right there.
Wow.
So, who knew? I mean, but and you know what? When it was done, who knew? Who would have known that it would take over the world?
It was
like
an
that?
International
yeah,
hit.
Yeah.
International.
Yeah.
Like, there are a lot of artists that... there was also, in Higher Gun, there was also a moment where one of the musicians said, it's important to write a good song, but it's more important, even so, to write a hit song. Because a hit song or something that resonates with people lasts generations. It becomes a classic. And Ghostbusters, in my opinion, is one of those songs because it crosses generations. It's been at least 4 decades?
It's 33 years.
I was about right. So yeah, I mean, that's cross decades. Yeah, they love
five
it.
5 years, 6 years, the they
reboot,
all know it.
Yeah, the reboot of Ghostbusters came out last year with an all girl cast, and people were all over it. Yeah.
Now we got the cartoon coming out. Then they'll probably do either another girls movie or a guys movie. So there's lots more coming.
I think they'll probably end up doing a sequel to the one that just came out, like they did with the original.
And then we got the clothing line coming out with the cartoon, the characters with the my words on top of the characters.
Nice.
All the kind of stuff. Yeah, so and it's come on, Halloween every year.
What's
the number one Halloween song? This is
Ghostbusters.
There you
yes
go.
It is. Between Ghostbusters and Elvira, y'all getting paid.
Exactly, yeah. All I gotta do now is get Elvira to sing Ghostbusters and Wiz's
own. You know
right?
what? That's a good idea. I worked with Elvira.
And you did?
I worked with Elvira.
Who you gonna call? Come on,
I'm gonna call Elvira from Ray Parker Jr. Exactly. That's who I'm gonna call.
That's a heck of an idea, ain't it? That's the idea right there.
We will hook that up.
Yeah.
I want to move forward a little bit and talk about, you know, in the 70s, the Gong Show was huge.
Yes.
Huge, 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 huge show. And now they brought it back. But back in the day, Cheryl Lynn was on the Gong Show.
She sure was. And she won the Gong Show.
And she won the Gong Show. And you ended up doing her first hit, To Be Real.
Mm-hmm.
How did you guys end up collaborating?
Well, what was interesting is I saw her win the Gong Show. And me and my buddies were like, that girl can really sing.
Yeah, she can.
And then a friend of mine that turned later, he got a group called Toto.
Yes.
David Page.
Mm-hmm.
He called me up because we were friends. We did some Joe Cocker records and some other records together. And he asked me, he says, I'm cutting a different kind of record than the Toto record, you know. And he wanted a rhythm section. So I got Gatson and I got my friend that played bass with me in high school in Detroit, David Shields. And we played on that record. And it was just, that was just one of those songs and records that there was not much we could do wrong. We actually cut at Richard Perry Studio, where we cut You Make Me Feel Like Dancing, right in the same room.
Oh, wow.
But this day, the sound was great. Everybody played great. It was just like the magic was in the air that day. There's nothing we could do wrong. Everything that we hit that day was just on top of
that
it.
That was a great song. And this is the best memory I have of her singing that song. So I used to be one of those avid Tai Bo people that would be in Tai Bo every day, kicking and squatting and doing whatever. And Cheryl Lynn used to go and take Tai Bo.
That's
and
right.
One day she was there and they played To Be Real. And she got on the mic and started singing it while we were kicking. I was like, this is the life right here. She's singing it for real. And we're going, yes.
Yeah, to be real.
Yes, punch, and kicking, and just living. It was wonderful, wonderful. So you've worked with Cheryl Lynn.
Yes.
You've worked with Whitney. What did you collaborate with Whitney on?
No, that's terrible. I did not work with Whitney.
No.
I got a sad story for you. Now, you know, I was supposed to work with Whitney, and Clive Davis personally took me to two or three places she was singing and asked me, said, would you just write a couple of songs, please?
And what happened, Ray?
I just didn't feel like doing it.
Hold up. You didn't feel like writing a song for Whitney Houston?
I just didn't feel like doing it, you know.
Wow.
How about that?
How you feeling about that right about now?
I feel real stupid. About as stupid as, I'll never forget, Prince's second album. I was supposed to produce that for Warner Brothers. And he was over my house and he played me the record. It has Sexy Dancer on it, you know. And I told him, it sounds great. I'm telling him, you don't need no help. Just put it out the way it is. So I talked myself out of money again that time.
It doesn't seem to be hurting you, though. So
no.
That's
why I made a lot of mistakes now.
You know, well, everybody
does.
Some,
but I got a lot of things right. But that's a couple of real big. That's Whitney Houston. That's a big one.
Yeah, I'd like to fix that one up for you.
Oh, my gosh. Two songs on the album that sold 20-something million records, and then I would have been on the second one that sold another 20-something. I mean, it would have, you know, would have made things a little nicer.
Okay, well, you didn't get to work with Whitney, but you did get to work with Chaka Khan, as we played at the beginning of the show. You got the love. Now, how do you all end up collaborating? Because she was part of Rufus at that point, right?
Well, this is you're going to love this story.
Yes, I'm excited.
Okay, so I'm working on this song. I want Stevie to cut it. He won't cut it. I want Barry White to cut it. He won't cut it. Nobody will cut this song. And next door to me was Andre Fisher, who played the drums.
Mm-hmm.
I played the guitar. And at that point, David Foster was playing piano with us. So three of us were out doing some record days. And I had this song. So he says, okay, I'll cut the song. And I'm like, yeah, but your band's new. I mean, nobody ever heard of y'all before, you know. And so we go in the studio and cut it because I ain't got any more options. Nobody else is going to cut my song. I got to get somebody cut it.
Yeah.
So they had a deal on ABC. I said, okay, well, I heard ABC before, so at least I heard the record company. I ain't heard of you guys, but, you know, You got to let me come in, play the guitars on it. Let's fix this thing up. You know, so I went in, directed everything, got it going. And I had some of the words, and I guess, I don't know how they finished it, but maybe I was out of town doing something. And Shaka came in and finished the words, and then she sang it. You know, and when I listened to it, I went, oh, my gosh, this girl can really sing. Who is this? Well, I mean, what we got here? You know what I mean? As soon as I heard it, I was like, that sounds better than I thought it was going to sound. And who is that singing? So finally, you know, she was having a baby at the time or something like that. And I went in and I said, hi, how's it going? Nice to meet you. I said, I think you really did a great vocal. She says, you don't remember me, do you? I'm like, no. And she says, I met you with Stevie Wonder backstage at the McCormick's place, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was introducing you to you and my sister, and I told you I wanted to send you our music, and you gave me some bogus address in San Francisco.
Oh, no, she called you out.
I lived in Detroit. I gave her she was right, too. Because I wasn't really hearing anything she had to say. I thought she was cute, and I was like, well, you know, come on, baby, I got something for this.
Oh, no. And, you know, you were there.
Come on, I was only a teenager. I mean, what do you expect? Right? I was a bad little boy teenager on tour. And here come these two girls to my day can sing. Everybody can sing. I heard all this before. And, you know, but see, God works in mysterious ways. So he let me have a hit on her. And instead of owning the whole band, all I did was write one song and have a hit.
I think that's fabulous. That is
and
my
I had to sit
jam.
And think. I had to sit and think about it. It's like, she tried to get me to sign her. And we obviously would have cut the good music anyway.
Did y'all ever work again after that?
No. I mean, wow. We do now, but we didn't then because, you know, she got the band, they went their way, and then I started radio, and I went my way. And
yeah.
Everything just got too big. But we've always remained friends. And she's my favorite singer by far. I mean, I love her and Aretha Franklin are the two unbelievable ones. And Cheryl Lynn, she's great too. But, you know, Shaka just has that way of making the notes do whatever they got
to
do.
She makes notes and music dance in a way that nobody else can. I
people
mean,
try to redo her songs, and I'm like, okay, you're a great singer. That stuff sounds great, but that ain't no Shaka Khan. No.
Let me tell you something. I went to see Shaka Khan down at Humphreys by the Bay, right? And she was not in good voice that day, and Lettucey opened for her. She literally ran and got Lettucey and had Lettucey come on and do her set for her. Mm-hmm. I got a whole new mad respect for Shaka Khan because there are a lot of artists that wouldn't do that.
Right.
They wouldn't let somebody take it's Shaka Khan.
Yeah. Exactly.
Really?
Yeah.
You gonna let this newbie who just opened for you take over your set?
Right.
But she did and stood there and supported her and was
the
lovely
time,
the whole time. Yeah. It was really, 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 really wonderful. I'm glad that I had an opportunity to witness that.
And by the way, she's a wonderful person too.
Just she seems like she is.
She's just cool. She's good.
She seems
she's
good like people, she is. I hope sure. I have an opportunity to sit here with her at some point. So if you had to tell somebody about Hired Gun, like why should people run out and go see Hired Gun?
Because you'll see things that you didn't know about the music business or that weren't in your imagination. Like everybody has this thing. Oh, Ray was sitting at home. Stevie wanted to call. Oh, that's wonderful. This is great, great, great. But they don't know that. Oh, well, one day you might get fired. Or you may quit. How does that go? Or did he get royalties on the record? Oh, no, he just played the guitar. He got $500 and that was it. He ain't getting no more money. You know, and some guys got, you know, I mean, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, they tell you about the time when they only got, after three platinum albums, they were making $110 a week or something.
What?
Yeah, you get the check framed and put on the wall.
That's madness right there.
There's more madness.
And then,
that goes
and they also, some of the musicians also talked about how, you go on tour like that, and they were saying, you know, so it's like this, you know, if you can play and you can sing, guess who's gonna get the gig? The musician that can sing
and play. That's right.
The As opposed to do, the one that can just play. The more you can do, the more viable you are on a tour. Because I used to sing backup for Tracy Chapman.
Oh, okay.
So I don't play no instruments, so my job was gone.
Gone. First one to go with the budget get cut.
Yeah, I was the first one to go, but I was the only backup singer. Yeah, yeah. Like, it was me and her, and that was it. But, yeah, I totally understand that. What other things will they see?
Well, the first thing that people don't know is they just see a musician playing with a famous artist, and they automatically assume they're making a lot of money. Not necessarily. And sometimes it's such a small amount of money that the musician can't even live.
Yeah.
And then the same musician can play with another artist. Doesn't have to be bigger, just different. And it's making too much money. So it just depends on what's going on and how they feel about it. And so, but this movie shows you different things. And I don't want to give away the plot, but it shows you different people, different things, and how some people resolved it, how some people were surprised and didn't know what was going on, and several things like that. And then there's a few people like myself and a couple others who figured out the only way not to get fired is to become the boss, and then you can fire yourself or hire yourself.
And then there's that.
Well, I think that's the best way to go. You know, like, I look at some of the other guys, and I'm like, when are you going to get to the part about you should have made your own record, and then you don't have to worry about the other guy anymore?
And, yeah, there was, well, I won't get into that, but there was one guy that did do that, and then it just kind of didn't work out for one reason or another. But,
and, you know, it's a funny thing about music. Everybody says, oh, boy, I write this song, I want Michael Jackson to sing it. Well, you know, okay, let's just say, for instance, Michael Jackson's the greatest artist. It's better to have a smaller hit on yourself.
That's true.
Than a super big hit on Michael Jackson.
That's true,
Michael
because Jackson, then the bar is set, and then people, and you don't have any place else to go.
Michael Jackson does the Coke commercial. He does the movie. He does everything, and you're sitting at home twiddling your thumb. But if you're the star on the same hit, then you can go out and do the half of the commercial he would do. And exactly. Half of it is a whole lot more than if he gets the whole thing.
Exactly. Well, you just said that you're your own boss. What other projects do you have coming up?
Oh, gosh. I thought you'd never ask. You don't have that much time on the show. But next door to my house, I built my fifth or sixth and last recording studio. And this one's beautiful. It looks like this room. It's got lights everywhere and high-definition cameras. We've got the instruments and color set up and all the stuff. Because we're going to do podcasting shows and TV shows and record. And my two youngest sons, they play music, so they're living in there, which to me makes it worthwhile already. And I'm still touring. I just did Singapore. I do Japan twice a year. I'm getting ready to do a Boss Skaggs album. I just did a Motown cartoon called Motown Magic, in which I'm one of the characters in the cartoon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I want to be like
Eddie
Murphy.
Where can we see that?
It comes out in January on Netflix.
On Netflix, okay.
Yeah. And I'm playing the guitars and all the stuff, and we're doing all the original Motown songs. Mm-hmm. You know, a bunch of Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, mm-hmm. Four Tops stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a lot of fun, because now you get the tapes and you get to break it apart mm-hmm. and separate the parts and play the stuff. So,
for an artist, because it's very different now than it was for you starting back in the day as a hired gun. For someone who is a hired gun in this industry now, what advice would you give them to try to avoid those pitfalls of, you know, not getting fired, you know?
This conversation I have every day, because I have two sons that want to play music.
Of course.
And every time they're going to drop some beats, I said, that ain't going to work. You got to do more than drop some beats. You know, you better take over singing, own the band. You know, I told my kids, I said, there's only two things I care that you do that are mandatory to me. You must, A, be the star, because the star makes all the money. They should stop with all this production and writer. The star makes all the money. That's why they call you the star.
That's the truth.
If you're the star, you make all the money.
But what about the ones that they don't want to be a star? They just want to.
They're stupid. it doesn't make any. What do you mean you don't want to be the star?
It's like saying
I don't want to make no money.
But you know as well as I do that there's some musicians out there that are just like, yo, I just want to be in the background and support the star and the other musicians.
Hey, there's always that guy who don't want the girlfriend. He just wants to introduce you to the girl.
Exactly.
Okay, well then you don't get no girls. Or you don't get no money. I mean, you know. And I've heard every excuse in the world. Well, I can't sing. Okay, well, I'm scared to be on the front stage. Okay, well, but you know, my example to everybody, and I tell them, the coolest guy in the world, he named himself Cool in the Game.
Okay.
Now, I want you to notice this. Cool does not produce the records.
No.
He does not write the records.
No.
He does not sing the records.
Definitely
not.
He
doesn't dance. He just stands in the back and plays the bass.
That's exactly what
he does. But it's Cool in the Gang. He's the star.
Okay.
He's the star of the band. It's his band. He's the star. It's called Cool and the Gang.
Okay.
And all that. He's the biggest touring act. He owns everything. And it's him.
All right. Now, do your sons have any product coming out that we should be looking
for? Yes, they're jamming too. We don't have a song. We don't have it ready to go out yet, but it'll be out this year.
Okay, so when they get their stuff, then y'all got to come back and talk to us
absolutely.
So that we can pump them up too.
Please. Yeah.
Right?
And these sports, they are slamming it.
I mean, you're not just saying that because they're your sons,
no,
right?
No, I take it out to
you're
other
not,
people.
You're not just being proud papa right now.
No, but I'm a happy papa because I think I'm going to get to live in the manner in which I've grown accustomed. You know?
And on that note.
So I have to see reality for real. I'm seeing reality. You know.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Thank you so much, Ray Parker Jr., for coming to join us at iTalk
Movies. It's too much fun.
Yeah. I had a great time. We were singing and everything. It was great. So you guys, get out. Watch the documentary Hired Gun, the documentary, through fathomevents.com on June 29th. That's 2 days from now, so you got to get your tickets because a lot of the theaters may be sold out. I've gone to some of those events, and it's a little sketchy. So not sketchy in terms of getting the tickets, but sketchy in terms of, you know, it being sold out and you not getting the tickets. So get out there, check it out. Be on the lookout for Ray Parker Jr.'s projects, his son's projects.
And I'm out of breath. All right. So this is Carla Renata, the Curvy Critic. You can find me at the Curvy Critic across all social platforms. And where can we find you, Ray Parker Jr.?
RayParkerJr.com, Facebook. You can find me everywhere, pretty much.
Great. All right. See you next time. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.